It's time for Twig. This week in Google, we have a really packed show. Kevin Toefel is back from the IoT podcast. He's filling in for Stacey Higginbotham, Jeff Jarvis, of course, and Joan Donovan from Data and Society. We're going to talk about the troll factories. We're going to talk about Twitter, what was the hot Twitter hashtag, Twitter lockout, what that all means. We've got a big story in the New York Times saying Google has gotten too big and needs to be broken up. We'll talk about all that and a whole lot more next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 445, recorded Wednesday, February 21st, 2018. The Mortician's Wife. This Week in Google is brought to you by WordPress. Make WordPress.com your online home. Plans start at just $4 a month. Go to WordPress.com/Twig to get 15% off your brand new website today. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, a show where we cover the latest news from the Googleverse. That's Facebook, Twitter, the media, everything, anything. Jeff Jarvis is here, professor of journalism at the City University of New York, author of What Would Google Do?, Public Parts, etc., etc. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. You're in the country for 2 days in a row.
I am.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, there comes the cat.
Yay. Yay, kitty cat. Hey, I'm really, we've got, Stacey's in Berlin, so we have decided to take her place with not one but two great panelists. To my right, Kevin Toefel, Kevin C. Toefel, of GigaOM fame for years. We couldn't talk to him because he was at Google briefly doing marketing. He's, of course, Stacey's partner on Stacey on IoT. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, hey, it's good to be back after all this time.
What have you been doing? We miss you.
Lots of Netflix, Nintendo Switch.
He's Netflixing and chilling. Listen to the Beatles, of course.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, I was over at Google for about 18 months, but I had to deal with some health issues last summer, which made me focus on myself for a little bit. And so I'm kind of chilling out and relaxing and now working with Stacey and enjoying life.
You couldn't pick a better partner, and you guys do a really good job on that IoT podcast.
Thank you.
It's really good.
Appreciate that.
And we are welcoming back, and boy, it couldn't be more timely, from Data and Society, Joan Donovan. Great to see you, Joan.
Hello.
She is responsible for reputation and media and fake news. You are in the hot seat right now at Data and Society.
Yeah, it's been quite a week of troll hunting, I have to say. It's been overwhelming.
Was it an 18-alarm fire when the indictment came out last week?
There's been that, and then conspiracy after conspiracy about Parkland, and then Twitter purge, or what are they calling it? Twitter lockout last night.
We're going to talk about that, yeah.
Sweep of the bots, and so really trying to understand how all of these things relate to one another.
So after Parkland, we're told that Russian trolls came out in force almost minutes later. And is it primarily Twitter? Do they still use Facebook?
It feels like they're everywhere, but it's interesting because it's like gnats, right? They're just a swarm of flies. You can't really measure the impact of what it is that they do, but they do tend to intervene in debates that are highly polarized already and then share specific kinds of accounts and conspiracy theories to confuse the narrative. And so it's been a busy, busy week trying to map that online, but then also trying to understand, is it really having an impact on the way that we're debating these issues, or is it noise, right? I mean, right. We're constantly
What's your view about that? Rasmus Nielsen at Oxford Institute has been posting stuff questioning how impactful it is. What do you think?
From my point of view, it's interesting in the sense that the amplification effect when they're retweeting known celebrity accounts or known provocateurs accounts, they do tend to spread the disinformation much further. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't have anyone really studying the impact of this on people's lives and if they're even reading what is being shared, right? Lots and lots of things get shared on social media that no one ever really reads. They might glance at it and roll their eyes and keep moving. So we don't know the impact it's going to have on shared reality or public understanding. And
the other
so
part of this is the media,
public.
Right? You know, yeah. The Data and Society has been arguing for strategic silence. And there was a case today, of course, where the survivors of the terrorist attack in Parkland, let's call them that, were being accused of being actors. And that's the kind of thing you want to just not give it more air. But when the president's son tweets it, then, you know, you got to go on TV. So Ali Velshi and Stephanie Ruhle today on MSNBC did a great, you know, debunking end to end, but it also gave it more air, right?
Why? What is to what? So first of all, I want to correct because I imply that you're in charge of fake news. you're not actually in charge.
It's all Joan's fault.
If you were
all powerful Joan,
it would make it much easier. But in fact, you study media manipulation and you're the research lead for platform accountability at Data and Society, which means you're an expert on fake news and media manipulation.
Yes. And we have a report that came out today that we are calling Dead Reckoning, Navigating Content Moderation After Fake News, because whatever interventions we pose on fake news or on what are these conspiracy channel news is going to affect the nature of all content online. And so one of the things that we've been talking about is this notion of strategic silence, which is when should you and when should you not amplify stories? And so when we see the crisis actor conspiracy taking hold in places like Twitter, on the one hand, if you fan the flames, that's exactly the kind of attention they're looking for. But also because David, is it last name is Hogg or Hogue? You know?
Two G's. I would guess it's Hogg.
Two G's. Yeah. So David's way of presenting himself has been extremely poised in the media, and that's what makes him as a survivor a very, very powerful advocate for gun reform in America. And that is very, very scary to certain conservatives. And you know,
we should point out he's one of the survivors of this,
and he's the one that's being charged with being a crisis actor.
Oh, they say this guy's an actor.
Yeah, because they argue that because he used to live in California, so they say, see, he doesn't even go to that school.
Oh my God!
And meanwhile, this is the amazing, amazing young man who, while they were locked up in classrooms, was interviewing his classmates.
Well, that's a little weird, but okay.
Well, he was
journalism focused, though.
He's a journalist.
He knew the conspiracy was coming. Yeah. You know, and so he was really doing due diligence.
Yeah, there are, of course, immediately people saying it's a false flag, that there was no shooting, things like that. So normally that stuff, I mean, this has been not just in the Twitter era or the internet era, but always. And normally you just ignore this stuff. And frankly, I guess the first thing I'd say is, why does Twitter, is it just the media that pays attention to Twitter? Twitter only has, you know, 300 million active users. I think the vast majority of Americans are not on Twitter.
So this was also being shared on Facebook and through YouTube. And
so you think that
InfoWars and the Gateway Pundit.
So all these people in aggregate reach a majority of Americans, you think?
No, definitely not. I think what happens is you have this narrative of a crisis actor that starts probably before Sandy Hook, but that's the first time that I've heard of it.
Yeah, I remember hearing.
And then it gets replayed through every mass shooting.
Right.
And so you no longer have to explain generally what you mean when you're talking about the crisis, the conspiracy theory of the crisis actor. Now what you have to combat is debunking these stories if you need to debunk them. And then also, I think that right now, those students that are survivors that are turning into advocates and organizers are really under attack. And showing, the media showing, as well as public support showing through Twitter that they believe those students and that they believe in their cause is one way to combat some of this disinformation. And I think it's really important for people to stand up and say that they believe these students, because these students are not calling for radical gun reform. It's very moderate.
I want to set aside the politics of it because this is a technology show. But what's interesting to us as a technology show is what is the internet's responsibility? What are these companies responsibilities, what is the power of the internet? And so, but I gather it's enough to plant the seed, and then also, you know, I just imagine a small town where there's a couple of people who, you know, they're on the internet, they see that, then they go to the coffee shop and they tell people in the coffee shop, you know, that guy was a crisis actor, and that that it spreads that way. It spreads beyond the internet to the majority of people not using technology, I would assume.
Yeah, it does, and it's a provocative story to tell. But what is dangerous about this?
We love these kinds of conspiracy theories.
Oh, it's true. But this kid is a teenager, and his real name is being used, and he's being smeared all over the internet. So now, when you search for him, not only do you get his name and his likeness, but you also get these conspiracy theories that are disinformation about him, which constitutes harassment. And so the videos that are popping up on YouTube and being shared through Facebook and being shared through Twitter are a kind of networked harassment that will plague him until we come up with some kind of regulatory framework that will allow him to get his name back.
Welcome to the internet.
I have a question. I don't disagree with anything you just said, Joan, but you mentioned how his real name is out there and he's a teenager. Does he put his own videos out on YouTube? Like, has he prior put his name out there? I'm thinking he has.
To be honest with you, I don't know. I haven't investigated in his own social media, but teenagers, the way that they use social media, of course, they do have a public presence. And as we grow older, of course, things happen and things get tied to our names. But the fact that there's no remedy for this, and there's no pushback, and that there's no formal process that this teenager can go through in order to get his name and reputation back, I think it's important that we start to think about what is the lifelong effects that he's going to suffer.
Well, I agree, but what would be the mechanism of that? I don't see any. I mean, that's the right to be forgotten.
That's the right to be forgotten. But you know, ironically, hearing you and Joan talk about this, the right to be forgotten is about taking down facts about you that you don't like. This is about taking down lies about you.
I don't know how you would do this. I don't know.
I don't know either.
How it would even begin. I mean, we all. It's worse, of course, he's a 17-year-old, but it happens all the time on the internet that people are tarred with a brush that and are stained in a way that there's no way to fix it. That happens all the time. And there's business and reputation defenders and things like that that are completely worthless.
The argument that I made, and I think this is why it's a very big story today, to put three things together here. The argument I made about this with Google in the spring after the election was that you're being manipulated. You have to understand the manipulation, measure it, be transparent about it, and counteract it. And so when Google announced they were going to account for the reliability, authority, and quality of sources in search ranking, that was them doing that. Now you have Facebook that is also trying to say, we're going to throw out all this public stuff getting in trouble and just bring back the quality stuff. And now today you have Twitter, which we'll get topic we'll get to in a few minutes, doing a blockout of Russian bots. So all three of the platforms are beginning to make decisions about quality and credibility.
Is it naive of me to say that really the burden is on in us as people to just not believe this crap?
if we can give people more signals that enable them to make that decision well, which is where
a new kind
of journalism comes in.
But if somebody believes that, I would guess they're well predisposed towards it. It's not that. It's like if I told you, oh, you know, that guy's an actor. Nobody was shot in Parkland. A normal person would say, get out of here. You're nuts.
Right.
Right.
But yeah, this is where the lack of trust in media goes. Sorry, John.
Yeah, no, I agree that there's a lack of trust, but also you are hosting content that is harassing someone, right? And we don't all get away with that. And so there has to be a new way of thinking about disinformation in particular because of the way that it's being used against platforms and to spread information that is not – What's difficult about conspiracy theories is that there's no falsifiability. There's no evidence.
You can't prove the negative. Yeah, yes. But that's always been the problem. That's life. Yes.
So in these situations, when you know that you have hundreds of hours of content accumulating in your platform, and you know that this teenager is being harassed, and he's being harassed because you are providing the distribution system and the archive for this content, then, you know, maybe he becomes the first person to sue one of these platforms for digital harms.
Well, the case of Google, I mean, YouTube is one matter, but Google search, it's not really, it wouldn't be the platform, it would be the originating site, but where it's come from. Google will argue strenuously that you should be able to find anything, including bad stuff. If you want to say who is out there saying the Holocaust is a hoax, you should be able to find that. Now, if you ask, is the Holocaust real? You shouldn't find them. But if you want to find the bad actors, Google will say you should still be able to find them because that's part of their job so that you can do your work, Joan.
Yeah, I understand. But I do not like being awash in disinformation. And I know that when it's targeting a specific person, that is a solvable and bounded problem, right? And so the evidence is in the metadata, and these platform companies do know who's uploading this content. They do know where it's being linked to, and they do have systems in place to deal with these issues, especially when it has to do with the networked harassment of an individual. And ultimately, this kind of harassment will not stop. This will go on for years.
It's going to go on for – this is trolls be trolling. This is trolls be trolling. I feel bad for David, absolutely. And he's, you know, he's on the side of the angels doing the right thing, and it's a sad thing. But that's what happens nowadays.
But it's not that we can't think about another internet or another way of interfacing with the internet and these platform companies.
Well, I'm open to the idea, but what would you propose?
Well, I don't work there, but if they want to...
I mean, really, though, I think this is a challenging thing. I mean, we've railed against the right to be forgotten. The internet, I hate trolls as much as anybody. I've been trolled for a long time. Trolls be trolling. What are you going to do about it? I don't know how you stop it.
The internet. This is a problem. If we believe that the trolls own the internet and that anyone should be able to do whatever they want to do at any moment, what's going to end up happening is that you are going to continue to accumulate so much garbage that YouTube is going to become landfill.
It's true. I mean, public network, if you don't maintain it, we have many, many mods in our chat room and lots of technical tools to prevent trolling in our chat room. And you have to be on it constantly to prevent that.
Well, so I think you're both headed to maybe a new standard here. The right to be forgotten, again, is a different thing because that's about erasing or rewriting history. This is about Joan. What Joan said is you're getting rid of harassment, and you with your mods are getting rid of harassment. So Twitter has a very low bar standard right now, which is child porn and such, right? And Twitter, I think, is showing that they want to raise that bar. So the question is, where's the bar? And there have been many complaints that women particularly get harassed and threatened on Twitter. If harassment and threatening no longer is a acceptable behavior on Twitter, is that a good standard, and is that something that's doable?
Is there a harassment structure in the eye of the beholder?
Well, that's the question.
if somebody responds to a presidential tweet saying you're a nitwit, is that harassment? Is that person blocked on the Twitter?
Well, I think that in some instances, Twitter has allowed for bad behavior from people that are of a certain status or of a certain distinction. Here we have a unique case that we can look at and say, here's a minor, and this is someone that we should strive to protect.
I agree.
This is someone's reputation that we should create a terms of service around, that there should be a process for making these appeals, and there should be rapid attention to these disinformation campaigns, because part of them, if you live in this world like me and my research team do, there's so many that don't hit this strongly. There's probably hundreds of Parkland conspiracy theories out there.
Right.
There's only a few that have been picked up and amplified.
So pick the most damaging ones. And actually, I think a very good job has been done to refute the conspiracy theory about Hogg.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, but if I search for David Hogg now on Twitter, Google, all I find is articles saying he's not a crisis actor.
But if you're people who don't believe media, the reputation, this is
it doesn't matter.
The Twitter fact checking flag, in fact, drove more traffic to those things that were fact checked false.
Yeah, the Facebook.
That's actually the problem. This is partly a technology problem and partly just a human problem. Just the other day, and folks in the chat room noticed it too. CNN went back to a Trump supporter's house said, look, it's been found that you were actually interfacing with Russian trolls, known trolls. We found this out. You were organizing events with them and so on and so forth. This person was like, no, that's all BS. No.
I don't believe you. You're fake news. Yeah.
It's a very good piece to maybe show. And that's the other half
of it. So how do you fix that? You can't with technology.
We have to recognize that the internet is Times Square. You know, I had an editor today on Twitter said, well, we should be, editing everything. You can't. It's an open conversation. So we've got to create. I don't want to go to an elitist hierarchy. I don't want to go to a paywalled quality world. But I don't want to imagine that if we just train people, everything's okay. We've got a big trust issue to deal with. And journalism has a huge trust problem. But at some point, if you recognize that it's Times Square, you're not going to listen to everybody on Times Square and think that they're right about everything. You're going to have some mechanism to judge.
And the other point that we should make is that these are known information pathways where there are content creators that make and monetize this content knowing full well that it is false. Sometimes they'll slap a "this is satire" on it, content to make it something that cannot be flagged and taken down. And so they know what they're doing and they know why they're doing it and there are economic incentives for it. And so it's not just true believers that are doing it because they're creating user-generated content. These are content creators and, quote unquote, media organizations that are making money off of this.
Yeah, I like your dead reckoning. This is opposed to Data and Society. Where really what you're saying, you're urging the platforms to news platforms to ignore this sort of, not to spread it by.
Unless it's passed over a line where you kind of have to, right, Joan?
Yeah, and one of the findings from this report is that what we're seeing on these platform companies is that we're at a moment where every action or every direction forward seems impossible. And so it doesn't surprise me to hear that you're like, how would we ever solve something? Yeah. And I think that my approach or the approach we should take is reason terms of service, but then also looking at case by case, does this information need to come offline? And can you create a process by which people can make those appeals and those appeals become transparent.
But there has always been, I mean, Jeff and I are old enough to remember mainstream media. And there was always a, and maybe you too, Kevin, there was always, I mean, you didn't say the names of minors. There were always,
you didn't talk about suicide.
There were understood rules that just were, I mean, I hate to use the phrase, but they were gentlemen's agreements You know,
no, I agree with you. Those are called standards.
Standards. There's the better word. There were standards, and there were even, there used to be in the networks, whole departments called standards and practices that would enforce those standards. And that was a good thing. But we don't live in a world of mainstream media anymore. And
no, we don't.
Even the mainstream media is not behaving like the mainstream media.
But the problem with broadcast that we've really failed to reckon with is, you know, that this there is an incentive to create this content because it makes money. There's an incentive to create this content because it creates political opportunities.
And you've got a 24-hour news cycle, and you got to fill the.
Yeah, and we have an ethic that says openness. I mean, after I just found this clip after Robin Williams' death. There was a 10% spike in suicides.
Yeah. So you don't say it. Right.
Yeah. And that's part of the knowing what to amplify and what not to amplify and what are the public health benefits of amplifying certain information.
But I'm kind of with Kevin that it's also the human problem is pretty big here. I think it's kind of to blame it on to say, well, it's all up to you platforms because we're just too stupid.
Well, this is the other intervention that these platforms are coming up with is that there are third-party fact-checking organizations as well as media literacy organizations that are under-resourced and they don't have enough personnel to deal with the scale of the problem and implement a sort of national digital literacy program that would cover a lot of what it means to debunk and read news critically these days.
Is it a bigger? You know, is the problem bigger than it used to be? Like
I would
measurably
say yes, because it has to be because I have a job now, right? And we have a team and we have lots of very smart people across the world working on these issues in every country. And it isn't just political disinformation. It isn't just foreign spies. There are real incentives to use the broadcast capacity of the internet, which as an infrastructure has rapidly scaled without any regulation.
Right.
It used to be that you remember the days of downloading a JPEG, right?
Right.
And it would sometimes take, five, 10 minutes to get a picture. And so as it's become easier to transfer data and we've moved into this mobile web moment, we haven't thought about what are the educational campaigns and the necessary tools that we all will need to be able to be critical
leaders. It's happened so fast.
But let me also argue.
We're just not prepared for it.
Sorry.
Please,
I'm doing research now on kind of looking at the post-mass world. And so I'm reading a lot of stuff. I just reread Amusing Ourselves to Death and other things from about 1960 to 1990. You know, so TV
like,
is huge. What's it
doing to
society?
People like Postman saw this coming, though.
Well, but they said it about TV.
Right.
Right? And they decried television. They decried what was going to happen. If you look at about 1960, after less than a decade of very popular televisions under our belt, there's a huge panic that goes on around then. And I think
mass media has empowered this, but we burned witches in the 1600s too.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I think that the problem, Joan, that I have with this notion of media literacy, and I get in trouble for this, but it's media centric. It's a little paternalistic to say if you just read all of our media and if you understood how to do our media, then everything would be okay. Maybe there's something wrong with our media. Maybe we got to start there. And maybe have more respect to the public. You listen to these Margaret Sullivan's column this week about the teenagers in Parkland is really wonderful. You hear the narrative is, teenagers are all apathetic and they're all illiterate and they can't spell and they can't speak. The teenagers of Parkland disabuse every such notion. And what made them this way? What made them savvy? The internet did.
By the way, right on the front of that article, a video of David Hogg. I admire these students because they, as much as anybody knew, he knew that becoming the public face of this would expose him to this. Maybe he didn't, but I would.
But he's being very mature about it now. I heard him today on TV saying about all this hoax about him. He said, well, it did a job for me. It doubled my followers today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
but
he has
going
more
back points. To Jeff's point about mass media, I think that we also have to. Remember that we learned how to watch TV, War of the Worlds. We learned how to listen to the radio.
Right. That's right.
That there's a format to it. And, you know, one of the Jesse Daniels, who's a researcher that wrote the book Cyber Racism, has a really beautiful earlier paper from maybe 10 years about using a usability study where she looked at how students learn to read the web. And she was looking at these websites called cloaked websites. So back 10 years ago, if you searched for Martin Luther King, you actually got a white nationalist website that had bought the domain and then was serving disinformation about Martin Luther King. And so students were taught to read into the infrastructure of the website, into the way that the content was presented. And in doing so, they were able to assess the quality of the news and the quality of the presentation in these websites and make an assessment of them. And so part of the way that we're doing media right now, though, is we have these generalized templates. Everything starts to look the same. And so it's mm-hmm. very difficult to tell the difference between legitimate news and what are these like incentivized, monetized news outlets.
Same is true in the news outlets themselves. I mean, our business model drives us to clickbait, drives us to polarization. We in media have not been nearly honest enough with ourselves about our responsibility in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so what are some of the main recommendations that your report makes, Joan?
In terms of what we're trying to understand here is that the report really does an overall assessment of these credibility indicators, as well as looking at what does it mean to disincentivize or to ban content or to remove content from your platform. And, you know, there are really mixed feelings about this in the sense that there are edge cases that get caught up in banning content. If you're banning all content that has to do with war or political speech, obviously that's a problem. But what we know is lots of disinformation flows in these content specifically. And so it's a fraught problem that the platform companies have, especially YouTube, has done a lot of work to demonetize certain accounts. And then, of course, you know that Facebook has changed the way that they serve information in the newsfeed. And so I think we're seeing a lot of experiments, and time will tell as we move on what this, you know, Twitter attack on the bot situation will also do to improve the information quality online. But for us,
can we talk really, about that now? Yeah, I'm eager to talk about that too. Yeah,
improving the information quality is something that's it's time has come. And then also to think about what is the editorial and the curatorial strategies that these trending algorithms are going to make that pick the content that you should look at.
So I woke up this morning and I saw a Twitter lockout going crazy, and I looked up the hashtag, and it was amazing reading. With people that had been followed by thousands of bots suddenly saying, I have fewer followers. And it was on the right. I didn't lose any followers. I don't know if you guys did. Russian bots don't like me, I guess. I don't know. And it was really, I think, an important moment where Twitter decided to make a stand here. What did you guys think?
Well, it just plays right into the narrative of those people who believe in the conspiracy theories and the left-wing media and left-wing Silicon Valley, and it just plays.
So, what
right
do you do? Leave
that.
The bots?
I don't know what you do. I feel like My problem is I don't understand the mentality of people like Dinesh D'Souza, who believe. You know, I don't understand how people. I don't understand. Why are people confused about this? And I think that's part of the problem we have, and maybe we can thank Russian bots for that, I don't know, is that we're so polarized at this point that there is kind of a gulf, a massive gulf. Forget the generation gap. We have a gap of massive proportions.
Reality gap.
A reality
gap.
Did you
see the New York Times article from about 2 weeks ago called The Follower Factory, which really went through...
Yes.
How bots are sold to influencers,
yes,
and celebrities.
We talked a lot about it. It's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is another iteration of that, which is that sometimes these aren't just what they call, quote unquote, suspicious automated activity, but that there are groups of people that are coordinating these accounts that are acting as a kind of flock. And so if you were to imagine a social media as a territory, and the social graph is something that these bots can really push content from one quadrant to another, right? And so it isn't just about intervening on and staying within the neighborhood of conservatives on the social graph. It's about pushing that kind of content into another vector and sometimes trolling other, partisan groups or creating highly polarized debate.
Did Twitter just kill a bunch of bots? I mean, they didn't pay attention to who they were following.
They killed bots, and then they also apparently, I think, accounts that seemed to have suspicious behavior, they made them verify with phone numbers.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Yes. So, and the verification by phone number is something that will also allow them to see if you are running 2, 3, 10 different accounts.
So when Richard Spencer says, I lost 1,000 followers in the past few hours, it's not because Twitter's targeting Richard Spencer's followers. It's just that he has a lot of these bots following him because that's the job of the Internet Research Agency and these other bot factories is to amplify these voices. What I find interesting is also that what is their agenda? Like, why did the Russian bots leap in Parkland? Is it because they don't want gun control, or is it, as I would imagine, more likely because they want strife, period?
Yeah, I would agree with you that strife is part of it, and part of it is making it seem that the terms of the debate are so unreasonable that you are so far apart on this that it can't possibly be reconciled. And so
what I was just talking about, that golf. In other words, I've been influenced by that.
Yeah, and the other thing that's difficult about this is they've been around before the election, and they've been influencing other social movement groups.
Yeah, so according to the indictment, since 2014, but I think probably forever. I mean, I don't think.
That's another problem of degree. So Adrian Chen had did an investigative report in 2015 where he went to the Internet Research Agency and basically said that it was a small time operation. But it doesn't mean that this operation hasn't grown since then. And because we lack the ability to assess the impact, and researchers, it's very frustrating in the sense that you find out about these things generally after the content has been deleted, and we don't have access to the deleted information. There was a cache of Russian tweets that were released this week, I think about 200,000 tweets that people are able to do a social autopsy on. But generally speaking, outside auditing is impossible. And so it's been a difficult moment to assess and evaluate impact to say if it's anything at all, or if part of the troll itself, which is what I suspect, is getting the American public to think that Russia has much more impact on American politics than they do. I mean, this is another tactic, which is if you can fan the flames of discontent in the mainstream media, it's just as good as doing it, or it's actually much better than doing it online, because the audience is so much bigger.
I'm so depressed now.
Well, don't be depressed.
But see, the bots, that's the bots doing their job, right?
Yeah, and the other thing is it's really suspect to me that people were able to go back to the IRA and they're still in the same building. And, I'm like, wouldn't you just move your office if you are a cause of international investigation and indictments, right? Like, what? Why do these people go back to work?
Pays well.
I don't think it does.
No, I've seen stories that say that relatively it pays well.
Okay, relatively. But it's still, to me, the whole thing feels orchestrated. But also, they've created such incitement around bots that it's been interesting to see the relationship of bots to known disinformation artists online. And so watching people respond in this Twitter lockout has been really interesting to me, because I've also seen several people that I follow having lost quite a bit of followers that are would be considered leftist. And so that to me has been interesting to think about in terms of what is that? What is that?
Is that the Bernie effect? The what the indictment said was that they tried to benefit both Trump and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. And so, and I think part of it is that some of the people that you follow or that I follow are would be considered quote unquote hyper partisan, that is, or they're non-voters in the sense that they're so left of left that the system cannot survive.
However, if you really want to visit the upside down, just read the hashtag Twitter lockout. Because
it's pick out some random accounts in there.
Okay.
Do we know how many? Do we know whether Trump lost followers today?
Oh, that's interesting. I have not been paying.
I couldn't
attention.
Find a service to know yeah. where to see.
A lot of people are saying. Just refollow me if you got kicked off, as if these aren't bots that have been kicked off.
Yeah.
Project Veritas added again, of course, saying, you know, with fake videos asserting that Twitter engineers are working to ban right wingers. Here's the famous Ben Garrison. Big Bird brother is watching you, trying to mute somebody wearing a Make America Great hat shadow banned. But I don't know. What do you tell people who say, no, those aren't bots? You're banning conservative thinkers and tweeters. And, this is clearly what these people think.
We don't know what signals Twitter is using in order to understand what is an automated account and what is not. One of the signals that has been used in the past is related to, does this account only do retweets? And do they have an authentic voice? Do they tend to post at the same time using the same exact tweet as a group of other accounts? So that would indicate a kind of net that's being controlled by a single individual. Another way that I've heard, but I cannot confirm in any way, a signal that they look for is related to, does this account click with a mouse? Which is something that can be tracked. And so if the account isn't clicking with a mouse, then it might be automated and coming from other places. Or is the account using a service, a social media service, to broadcast the same information between Twitter and Instagram and other platforms? And so they have a mishmash of signals that they look to in order to talk about which accounts are bots. And then the other thing that I think serves them over time is that you get the same network effects related to certain stories. And so the same groups of people that are promoting the crisis actor narrative here have been creating or promoting crisis actor narratives in the past. And you can analyze those accounts and look at those networks and then look at those other signals to see if they're automated or only doing retweets and assess from there. And so I think that Twitter knew roundly what they were doing and were looking at many signals to assess if something was a bot. But also, back to this is a socio-technical problem. Bots are controlled by people. And so that just means the difference between me having one account and me having 10,000.
I don't know why anybody pays any attention to Twitter at all, to be honest with you. It's
well, but here's the thing, Leo. It's what I've said about Facebook too. The problem is you go through your feed and I go through my feed. Joan has a job looking at this crap, but we don't. And I don't see Russians. I don't see bots. I don't see Nazis. I see people I like and respect. And the problem is we still have this media mindset that says if one page is schmutzed, if there's a bad word somewhere on the internet, the entire internet is ruined. All of Facebook is ruined. All of Twitter is ruined. It's not the case. And we've got to keep that kind of perspective in mind.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's a lot of hope for Twitter.
Well, there's certain
Does the world need Twitter?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. Does the world need anything? I don't know. What do we really need? This is philosophical.
A good book, a nice glass of Chardonnay, and I'm happy.
Your head at night, you know, $40 bucks.
Kevin's thinking, boy, this. I just deal with devices now. It's so much nicer.
It
to
is.
Behave.
It's a lot easier. But okay. here's where my guilt shows up. So we're going to switch over to some other topic, and I feel like it's almost burying your head in the sand to talk about all Android phones and this mess is occurring on this thing that we loved called the internet. So I don't know. Maybe it's too easy. This is you're right there, Joan. They're getting to me.
They shouldn't get to you.
They're getting to me.
I've listened to you for years in California.
I just want to celebrate. I want to celebrate technology. But it's
put down the Kindle and looking at a book. What are you thinking? What are you doing with your time?
Well,
the other thing is that these things are bound to certain features online. Jeff's right to say that if you curate your feed and you don't look at hashtags,
right?
Generally speaking, you're not going to fall prey to this. This kind of disinformation happens in breaking news cycles. It happens in crisis. And those are bounded problems. It happens to individuals that can be solved for. And
just don't click the moments button, whatever you do, in other words.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, the other thing here is I think that the two people I know who have for their careers have had to deal with the worst crap of the internet are two of the nicest people I know. That's Joan Donovan and Matt Cutts. So somehow they've managed to keep their sanity, but we can't.
Well, I do... I do a lot of this work, but at the same time, I have to have faith in a humanity or else,
ultimately, yeah.
What pains me, Leo and Jeff, is that I love the internet. I do. I love technology. I love toys. I love things that move. I love things that blink. I love tape and telephones. And so, but I don't think we've actually lost the fundamental infrastructure of the internet. These products are built on top of it, right? And so if we think about them as the end-all be-all of the internet, then we're really only looking at one, we have a one-dimensional problem. But fundamentally, the internet's still there. It's still critical infrastructure, and there's still many opportunities for us to either create small worlds networks where people are cloistered away from this, or that it's more difficult to move across the social graph, or we can temper this with a good dose of what I remember from the 90s, which is that we didn't believe what happened on the internet was real anyway.
That's where we went wrong, starting to believe this crap.
Part of it was all of our institutions moved online, education, media. We all started, and our banking moved online, and then things got really serious. And I think that we can, one look back, one step forward, and try to understand that the fundamental infrastructure is still there and that we can remake it in another way.
Let's take a break. And we'll come to something Kevin can talk about. Poor Kevin. Kevin Toeffel is here. It's great to have you back, Kevin. I really is.
Kevin's been able to read through the rundown now.
Yeah, now you know all the stories we're going to talk about next.
I was getting rid of my bots.
Did anybody – I didn't see – I don't remember what my Twitter followers were, but it's – it's roughly the same.
It tells you it tells you whether they've gone up or not. Mine went up.
Where does it tell you that?
If you go to your Twitter page.
See, that's part of the problem. I don't even know how to use this thing.
I didn't know it either.
Is it on?
It up today.
Okay.
If you look at, where the heck is it? You look at
the stats, following
analytics.
Followers.
Analytics. Yes.
Yeah, I do have some analytics somewhere.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah, here we go. View your top tweets, your tweet activity. Is there a link to analytics? What is the...
Your profile picture at the top right, your icon profile. Pull that down.
Thank you for helping me use this. That's wonderful. Sure. Analytics. So this will tell you whether you've lost followers or gained. New followers. I'm down 244 bots. I mean followers.
I'm up 26 followers.
Kevin, what's your?
I'm up 39.
So obviously I'm the right winger here. Joan.
I'm looking. I can't find it, though.
Go to your Twitter page. Go to the picture. Kevin just said this. I'm just
click your head. Choose analytics. Click your head.
Okay. Click on my head. Choose analytics.
Unless you don't have your head as a... you know, it's really interesting. Some of the most vile people on Twitter don't use their own pictures. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, well, like the frog Twitter is real.
Pepe.
Whatever happened to the egg? The egg is gone.
No, they don't use an egg anymore, yeah. So I've lost 244, which I'm perfectly happy to lose. I don't pay any attention to the number of my followers anyway. Not since Kevin Rose beat me in 2007 for the number one most followed person on Twitter.
Still
ever since then,
bitter about that,
I'm
are we?
Still bitter about that. We were on a race to 5,000, and he beat me. 5,000 followers, which was everybody.
Yeah, it was.
All right. Where am I looking for in audiences? Where do
analytics? It's over. And then once you get to that page, it's on the right hand side. There's a column that's February 2018 summary. Oh, that's 244 for February. So
it's on the top. It says followers down 436.
Oh, look, there you go. This is 28 day summary. So followers 28 day. Well, that's probably because I'm just boring. I don't post anything of interest on Twitter. I just post news stories.
I get 81 clicks a day, 25 retweets a day, 43 likes.
Actually, I should pay more attention to Twitter. Apparently, I have 1.91 million impressions over the month. That's a pretty good number.
I guess.
I don't
know. Compared
that's
to what?
Influence.
What does an impression mean? Does that mean somebody scrolled past my tweet?
Yes.
I think that's pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Big deal.
Yeah. I'm still not seeing followers for some reason. I don't know what's going on with me. But
you have been blocked, Joan.
It's a state
Donovan.
Secret for you.
Yes. Let's take a break. Come back with more. Joan Donovan is also here from Data and Society. She is in charge of fake news.
Today.
She is actually doing the most interesting job you can even imagine. At Data and Society, her title is Project Lead on Media Manipulation and Platform Accountability, which is fascinating. So
if you want to work for me, I'm hiring.
Wow.
So come on in.
What kind of skills does somebody need to come to work for you?
Probably a lead lined stomach.
Yeah.
Come back the next day.
I honestly took Twitter and Facebook off my phones. I never feel good afterwards. And mostly I use things like Nuzzle to look at what's going on Twitter because it just aggregates news stories. It just makes me feel bad. I don't like to
feel bad. I mean, it's like anything, you know, it can get, once you get stuck in those echo chambers, right? You know, you start seeing the same content over and over and over again, and it just feels obnoxious, right? It just feels like, what am I even doing here? I'm reading the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. Those Russian trolls are bringing me down, man.
I can't believe they got to you. Of all people, I don't even know.
Are they all Russian or are they from other places too?
This is the other thing is this is an agency for hire. They could be from anywhere.
Erdogan in Turkey decided, I need to get my word out on Twitter. He could go to the Internet Research Association and say, can I get a few bots to help me out? They're not bots. They're by the way, we shouldn't call them bots. That's not fair. Mm-hmm. They're actual people.
They're using two technologies. One is there's just the sort of human element where they're using sock puppet accounts, pretending to be either organizations or individuals. And then the second layer of it is some of it is automated and they have bots set up to amplify those accounts, to follow those accounts. And so that's what we refer to when we refer to a botnet.
Okay.
And then the other thing that's important to understand is like there's this, but then there's also an entire industry devoted to fake followers. That has cropped up in order to game these algorithmic systems,
right.
So that
that's just commerce.
Yeah, but you can still buy and use those same followers in order to do the work that you're trying to do.
What are the chances that the NSA or other federal U.S. federal agencies don't have the same capabilities?
I mean, like, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, in my work,
if anybody has a right to, Joan, you do.
In my work with movements, you know, we know that movements have been infiltrated for years. Entire COINTELPRO programs have been set up to infiltrate movements and infiltrating movements through social media
and using social media to,
you know, influence movements.
I think we have a bot gap. I think we need to get some bots in Russia. Let's go after the Russians.
Yeah, Leo Laporte hacks Russia.
We need a bot. There's a bot gap. We need to, our own internet research agency there in McLean, Virginia, to get
chat room. You got a new job.
Go get the Russians. Screw with them.
This is the other thing. Is like, you know, they've dedicated a multi-year propaganda plan here, and getting Americans to do things for that long without any specific reward. I mean, it's going to be hard to engage, you know, formalize that kind of civic engagement. Oh, of course, I'm being facetious
here. It helps when you're a totalitarian regime.
It does. It really does. And as well, we do know that the U.S. has run social media operations in other countries in order to influence, you know, networks of actors. And so that stuff is well known. And so one of the things that I often refer to when I talk about our understanding of social media is that it's not a reflection of reality. It's a bit of a funhouse mirror. And if we don't understand its distortions through manipulation, then we don't understand the reality that we're living in, which is partly mediated by screens. And then there's the stuff we see with our own eyes.
Jeff, it's your fault. I'm looking at August. I lost 878 followers because of your Trader Joe's queso tweet. I blame you. I blame you, Jeff Jarvis, City University of New York, professor of journalism, helping us navigate the mainstream and otherwise media. And Kevin Toefel, his triumphant return.
I don't tweet about politics or queso.
Yeah, me neither.
Man, safer that way.
Safer. Kevin is at the IoT podcast with Stacy, and Stacy's in Berlin. What's she doing in Berlin?
She is freezing her behind off.
Is it cold
there? It's very cold.
Oh,
yeah. She's at the Bosch IoT event that they have for several days.
Yeah. That's right.
Not my thing.
Well, we're glad you're with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. How do you feel about Chipotle queso?
I've only had Chipotle once, to be honest.
He's too healthy. He doesn't eat that stuff.
No. Don't let the running every day fool you. No.
That's why you run.
I had a meatball parm sandwich for lunch that I put on Facebook today because the dog was trying to eat it.
So. Oh, mmm. Yeah. Now, see, I'd follow any meatball parm account. No problem. Them's my people.
Jeff probably knows Wawa. Best meatball parms.
Yeah, I do. Hey? My son loves Wawa.
There you go. My son works for Wawa.
Oh, wow.
How have I not heard of Wawa?
Because it's an East Coast thing.
It's a 7-Eleven, but it's oddly cult-like.
It's a convenience store?
Yeah, sandwiches. They have more fresh made food. Well, fresh may be a stretch, but they have more made food.
It's fresh. I've seen how the sausage is made. I know. They started out as just milk delivery way, way, way back in the day in Pennsylvania, and they've expanded to hundreds of stores throughout the tri-state area and all the way down to Florida now.
Yeah. Mm. And you go in. It's very techie. You order on a little a screen.
A screen.
And
get your, They don't serve bots either.
Savor Wawa's hot hoagies. That is a mouthful. They are not our sponsor today, however. I wish they were. I could use some of that Wawa hoagie money. But actually, I'm very happy to have WordPress as a sponsor because I use WordPress. I've been a WordPress fan since they started in the early 2000s. And if you are a business or even an individual and you don't have your own personal website, if you're trying to make it as a Facebook page or a Twitter account. No, man, get yourself a website, a WordPress. WordPress.com makes it easy. I know you're intimidated. Maybe you think, I have to know about web design, right? No,
You don't need experience. You don't need to hire somebody. WordPress.com guides you through the entire process from start to finish. They do all the technical stuff, including keeping it up to date. They've got hundreds of beautiful templates to choose from, designs. They've got all the plugins that you could turn on Google Amp for speeding up your mobile loading. I do that. Built-in search engine optimization makes Google happy. Social sharing, so you don't have to put it on Twitter. Your fans will tweet about you or Facebook about you. If you're a business and you don't have your own personal website with your own domain name, I feel like in this day and age you barely exist. You've got to do this. This is table stakes. And what a great customer support team. You'll never be at sea because they're there 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday, weekends too, to help you. They love helping you. Plans start as little as $4 a month. And here's the thing. 29% of all the websites in the world, 29% run on WordPress. You'll be joining a community of nice people. Get started today with 15% off any new plan purchase. Go to wordpress.com/twig. I'm there. Will you join me there? 15% off your brand new website, wordpress.com/twig. We thank WordPress so much for their support of this week in Google. All right.
I just hired a new president or CEO. I forget which it is, named Kinsey Wilson.
I wanted to mention this because I saw your tweet and you said, this is so good. And so why is that so good?
So Kinsey was a USA Today top editor, and then he was in charge of digital and then all news content at NPR.
So he's a journalist.
And then he was at the New York Times. Yeah, Kinsey's a really top-notch media executive. So I think it's good for us in media.
That's
wonderful guy.
That's really good. So just now he's been hired. I mentioned this last time and I couldn't remember his name because I saw your tweet about this. Nice. He is now at WordPress. Fantastic news.
As I think, I don't know, CEO or president, or I think Matt Mullenweg is chair or.
Yeah, Matt. Of course, like I've known Matt for years. This is him, right? Yeah, delighted to be joining the growing team at WordPress.com and parent company Automattic. Iconic champion of the open web. Many more chapters to write. So that's pretty awesome.
It is.
Yeah. Well, we only do advertisers for companies I feel good about. And
this is one that's easy to feel good about.
It's easy to feel good about them. I completely agree with you. Let's see here. All right, let's change the subject. Let's find something exciting about technology, something wonderful. Google removes the image view button from search because Getty talked him into it. Now this is going to lead into
it might be a genteel way to say that.
This is going to lead into this big New York Times Sunday feature that's coming up this Sunday about the case against Google. That's the name of it, but it's a little more nuanced, that article, than that. But Getty was mad because, other sites, Google, in their image search, would put Getty's custom images there, and you could click a view image button and just download it. And Getty felt like that was, foul play. They actually sued, and it's believed this is part of the settlement.
You can still right-click on the image and download it, right?
Yeah. Yep. And there are already Google Chrome plugins that restore the download image button. But I don't tell Getty about that.
See, this is the problem when you want to be the purveyor of all the world's information, you know?
Yeah. So Google's mission statement is what? To put all the...
Organize the world's organize information, the world's make it accessible.
Make it easily accessible, right? But as Charles Duhigg points out in his New York Times Magazine piece, Google's business is advertising. And the search is really just a way of driving advertising traffic. And and he tells some stories in here that are pretty compelling. Google doesn't seem to be unwilling to inconvenience competitors. He starts with telling the story of a company called FoundMe.
Foundm
was what they call a vertical search. So Google's regular search is horizontal. It searches everything. Foundm was designed to help you shop. And it's something Google historically wasn't very good at, searching for white tennis shoes with free shipping
that have wide sizes under $40. That's a hard thing to do on Google, but Foundum was designed to do that, and apparently they were very good at it. But you may never have heard of them because as soon as Foundum went public, they disappeared from Google's search index. Wow. Google, they have been chasing after Google for a while. They went to they actually met with the FTC in the United States. As we know, the FTC declined to prosecute Google over this, but the EU did, and they felt vindicated when the EU fined Google a record $2.7 billion just a few months ago. There are many examples in here, and Duhigg, who has written a couple of books, basically it implies that it's time to break up Google, that Google is not only a monopoly, but is willing to use their monopoly position in search to get rid of competitors. Jeff Jarvis?
So give me a minute, then I'll leave. I think this piece is manifestly unfair to Google. Google has no word at all until six paragraphs from the end, where it's also kind of blown off. We're savvy enough on this show to have talked about Panda and the changes that were made in Panda. And if you go to the days...
Panda was the new search algorithm that did, in fact, hurt Foundum.
It hurt Foundum and it hurt others. So About.com, where I consulted when the Times bought it, was invented a whole new form. And then demand media came along and messed it up. And then there were all these content farmers messing it up. And Google had to have a formula for its algorithms to say, what are we going to do about that? We're going to get rid of a bad content experience. And yes, demand media was put down, but so About.com went out, you know, was the dolphin caught in the tuna net. And it went out too, basically. It went way down. In the case of Foundum, I mean, I looked at Foundum back in the day when these complaints came up. Google's complaint is they don't want sites that are just a whole bunch of lists of links to make money off those links. And Foundum, in fact, appears to be just that. It may be better than that. It may be fine that, but the mechanism here.
Although Duhigg points out that that's exactly what Google is.
Well, that's a little bit ambiguous.
That's exactly what Google does: a bunch of links to make money.
The mechanism here. No, Google actually has links to content. This has links to just deals and advertisers.
Yes, because it's a shopping search engine. Exactly what it should have.
Give me my minute. Give me my minute.
Okay.
Give me my minute. So the mechanism of taking an algorithm to take down the latest trick of the spammers or of the manipulators, in this case, there are lots and lots of sites that were just link farms. Foundum looked like that. Now, Google may have done a bad job, or Foundum may, in fact, have been that. I think that they're being martyred a bit. I don't think it was that good a site. I don't think it was that wonderful when I saw it back in the day. Now it's down, so you can't really compare.
Right.
But this is the way that Google operates. And there is, in this story, there is zero acknowledgement of that kind of manipulation and spam management. And if we had Matt Cutts here, he could talk about, I think, that from a higher level. That's not in that story whatsoever. This is an effort to say, this is advocacy as pure as it comes, to say, let's break up Google, and here's my sob stories about what happens. But a lot of those cases, A, they weren't necessarily good sites, or B, like About.com, which was a good site, when that formula got manipulated too much, it went out with that. End of spiel.
What about, this is a different technique Google uses, Skyhook Wireless. We've talked about Skyhook before.
This one's different,
This is a different methodology, and I don't know the facts of this case. I'm just taking Duhigg's assertions as fact. So if somebody has a counter story, that's fine. Skyhook, we know about. They were basically a location service using Wi-Fi, and they went around and they mapped everything so that if you didn't have GPS in a device, you could, based on triangulating the Wi-Fi signals, you could see, figure out where you were. This competed, obviously, with Google's location software. In fact, Google Street View went out and started to do the same thing. Right. A lawsuit filed by Skyhook against Google in the discovery revealed an email from a Google manager, an internal email that said Skyhook's accuracy is better than ours. Not long after that note, it was written, according to Duhigg, and the lawsuit, a high-ranking Google official pressured Samsung and Motorola to stop using Skyhook and said, if you don't, we could make it difficult for you to ship your phones on time. Google's denied this, obviously. So soon after, Samsung and Motorola canceled their Skyhook accounts. Skyhook sued Google, and though one suit was dismissed, Google ended up paying $90 million to settle a patent infringement claim. But by then it was too late. Skyhook founders, bereft of other partnership options, had been forced to sell their company at a large discount. Yeah, now, I don't know the facts of this case, so I'm just quoting here. But if that's true, is that not exactly the kind of anti-competitive behavior that a monopoly uses to protect itself and keep and to enter new businesses, keep others out of that business? That's exactly what antitrust law is meant to do.
But I'm just going on the evidence of how the Foundum case was handled. I don't think it was handled journalistically very well.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Maybe he's got it wrong.
And listen, Google is not pure as the driven snow. Google is a gigantic company where people can do bad things. All these companies can. And they can mess up. And so I'm not defending them wholeheartedly against all possible sins by any means. Just this Foundum case, I think, is a red herring that was also jumped on by Vestager in the EU. She wanted an excuse to go after Google. But did Google do other things that were bad or misuse their authority or their power? Maybe they did. I don't know.
So a couple of things here, just from having the perspective of having worked for Google. I cannot name a single Googler that doesn't want to do the best thing for the end users. I just couldn't. They were all fantastic in that regard. And I think Google's vision was to do that. But once you become beholden to shareholders, you have incompatible goals now. And I think that's a large part of the problem, trying to balance that. Because quite honestly, if Google's got a competitor such as, a Skyhook Wireless that does have a better solution, and I remember when this all happened, and I remember Skyhook, and it was a good solution, the folks, the rank and file, you know, they want the best for the users. But at some point, management knows the buck stops with them and with the shareholders. So what do they do? I don't know how you reconcile that. And Google's now a big entity that is beholden to shareholders. So there's a big issue there.
But Kevin, you could be beholden to shareholders in an evil way, Uber, or you could be beholden to shareholders and say that the company that we are has a standard that we're going to behold because that's our business. I think that's closer to Google. Are they perfect? No. But I think you're right. Everybody I've ever met at Google holds rather religiously to users. And so that's at least the pressure that's within. That's the don't be evil. That's the license to be able to say that.
So we could put this particular conversation aside because I would like to say, and we talked about this in Windows Weekly, maybe the higher level conversation. And it brings us back to Scott Galloway's book, The Four, in which he says that that these big tech behemoths, these companies that are so big, they, in Duhigg's words, blot out the sun, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and Google, are bound to come under scrutiny soon because they are getting so big.
Well, they're under it.
There's nothing, by the way, I would not buy into the notion that just because a company's big, it's bad. I think that that's a value judgment that some people make, but I don't think
it's going to stay big on its own.
Yeah.
Microsoft.
But I think, yeah, and Duhigg uses the Microsoft example. He says if the DOJ hadn't sued Microsoft and gotten them looking over their shoulder, there might not be a Google.
I don't.
Microsoft's taken its foot off the pedal, gave Google an opportunity, and that's really the larger philosophical question. I'd love to know what you guys think. There is one current of thought that says technology is different than any other monopoly situation. Duhigg mentioned Standard Oil. There's AT&T's breakup in the '60s. In the world of technology, some innovator is going to come along and you're going to get out innovated. And no matter how big you are, and all these companies, including, by the way, Standard Oil, got big because of technological innovations they owned, that somebody's going to come along and disintermediate you. There might be some evidence that's already starting to happen. Facebook's starting to slip a little bit. So there's some who say in the 21st century, we don't have to worry about this. Don't worry. Antitrust regulation takes so long, took more than a decade in the case of Microsoft. It's too slow. It's not effective. Just let the market handle it because technology, it's the nature of technology, that innovation will solve this problem. But there's the other side that says maybe that's true, but if there's going to be a point where Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Apple, and Amazon particularly, are so big, Amazon's already getting there. Look at Walmart just stock just tanked. It lost $31 billion in market cap, 10% of its stock value. Toys R Us is gone. They'll get to be a tipping point beyond which you can't fix it because all you got is Amazon. So,
yeah,
thoughts.
So I've been, you know, in the article, one of the things that was compelling to me is, and one of the things that I wanted to know more about in terms of Foundum was, were they a relative competitor that could make a kind of Google shopping service irrelevant, right? And so, and then, you know, showing the case of Skyhook where, you know, that the company eventually had to sell out because it couldn't compete. You know, there's some evidence that even if Google isn't doing it on purpose, downranking websites or forcefully pushing apps or technologies out of business, is that it's not a good look for a company that really has expanded to a bunch of different features and is known for acquiring technologies and sometimes you know, either killing them or integrating them poorly into the system. And then the other thing that I'm wary of, and Jeff, we can argue over this, is the algorithm made me do it is, you know, one of the most difficult excuses for me to, you know, to swallow at this point, knowing that these algorithms aren't, you know, we know what they do. And in the design of them, these what engineers would love us to believe as accidents are design by design. And so I don't know the case. I don't know. I never worked for Google. And so I can't say that this is the case with that algorithm. But we've started to see a pattern of these companies blaming the technology and how the technology sorts things without taking accountability for the effects or the consequences of those algorithms.
Yeah, let me respond, because I think it's not so much blaming the algorithm as it is the ever-present desire to have a rule set under the excuse of scale. And ironically or paradoxically, it's almost saying this is their definition of fairness. Well, about.com, we now have 100 competitors to you who take your formula and schmutz it up, but we got to treat all of you exactly the same because that's what we do. We have a formula that says, if you look like this, this is how we're going to treat you now. And so we're not going to make a gradation difference between about.com, which is good, and demand media, which is bad. Same thing happened to Facebook. Facebook said, because Facebook was not nearly nuanced enough about its non-social public content. It considered all public content to be basically the same, point you made earlier about media. And so when bad social content got them in trouble, or public content got them in trouble, they threw out all public content because their formula wasn't nuanced and smart enough. So I'm not really defending them so much as to saying this is how they think. And they try to come up with that formula. They're not blaming the algorithm so much as they're saying we have to have a rule set. Now, what I think I'll agree with you, Joan, is they need to have a smarter rule set.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with Kevin that everybody at Google, I'm sure, is wonderful and really just wants to help the customer. You could probably say the same thing about Facebook and Amazon and Apple. But companies, corporations act in aggregate sometimes in ways that the individuals wouldn't necessarily support.
Would you say the same thing about Uber?
Well, that's an interesting question.
I mean, right. So I don't
if
think,
Uber,
I think
if Uber had a monopoly, I think Uber, culture. There'd be no question. Yeah, that's company culture. But I mean,
well, in Europe, it is a monopoly. I mean, if you're in, you know, it's being kicked out of places, but if you're in Berlin or London, there's no competitor.
There's also, and you put, I think you probably put this article in this opinion piece in Bloomberg from Leonid Bereshitsky, which is a Russian troll name, a bot name if I ever heard one. Now, he's saying that Margareta Vestager was influenced not by a desire to help end users or even improve competition, but by lobbying. And you've always mentioned this from publishers. In Germany and so forth, who didn't like the fact that Google was beating them in the marketplace. And that is for sure another avenue for this stuff is that, competitors sue instead of winning, you know.
Which is the case of some of those in the Google story. These are some competitors and they are disadvantaged competitors because they're smaller. True. But that's an issue.
Yeah.
Well, that's not entirely. Jeff, are they just disadvantaged because they're smaller? I mean, in the article, you know, Google is portrayed as the 800-pound gorilla. It's not so much that they're smaller; it's just that they just don't have the influence. I grew up when the internet was AOL. It was synonymous.
Right.
Now Google is synonymous with search. Yeah.
You're not on Google. You don't exist.
Yeah, but I'm not. Right. What I'm saying is that I don't think Foundom was a competitor. I think Foundom was a type of site making money that Google, in its rule, said this sites that look like this are almost always bad for users.
I mean, Twit is an example of a company that struggles because Google and Facebook are so good at selling advertising that it's hard for us to sell against them.
I don't
blame them as I wouldn't sue them saying you're putting me out of business. They're doing their job and they're doing a better job of it for some advertisers. They want all that data. They want all that information about who they're, you know, selling to. I'm not going to give them that.
Well, I've long argued that where Google is most in trouble and Facebook are most in trouble when it comes to antitrust and monopoly is not in search. It's not in social. It's not in any of those areas. It is in the advertising market.
But that's the point of this article, which is that Google's advertising revenue drives all these decisions.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that Google has the power of God in advertising. If its rule puts you, if they decide that you are a bad actor, then you're out.
Do we want any company to have that capability?
So I have argued that I've said this on the show a dozen times over the years since the beginning. I think Google would be wise to have juries of peers. If you look at it this way, if they had 100 advertisers, trusted good advertisers, and said this place has come along and they've complained, and they found them and says we're treating them wrong. Now the advertisers have an interest in having a credible marketplace. And if the advertisers say, no, they're actually okay, they're all right. Then you go to Joan's question of how do you change the rule to allow them in and say this defines good and this defines bad. But Google does have the power of God in that one instance, and I think that's what's going to get them in trouble in the long run, yes. And they should have come up with structures that were different to account for that.
I mean, I believe, I should say very clearly in our advertising model, that it's more efficient, it works better than automated ads placements in Facebook and Google. But it's hard to get above the noise that Facebook and Google make and convince advertisers of that. But that's my job. It's not my job particularly, but that's our job as a company, is to say, well, we believe we have a credible alternative. But if Google should decide for some reason that we were a threat, see, that's why I want to stay small.
That's
oh, well, we're not going to put you in the search rankings. I mean, if that's what happened to Foundom, that's appalling.
If.
So that's the higher level question is, I think we could agree we don't have enough data to know if this stuff will write itself automatically, if it's the nature of the technology business cycle. But the problem is if we don't act, there will be a tipping point beyond which there's no recovery. I mean, it'll just be like, well, you can't compete with Google. You just can't beat Amazon. Facebook owns this. Right.
Well, that gets to your question that you asked earlier about, you know, monopolies and competition. You know, there's always been some new innovation to dismantle or take the place of a large company. At some point, let me backtrack. Google's currency is information. The product is information. All these prior examples of Standard Oil and Microsoft and all that, those were like physical products. But at such a granular level, can it be any more granular than information? How does somebody out Google at this point? Is, you know, with IoT, with connected cars, it's everything is information, and information is currency today. What would it take to out Google? I don't know what there could be.
Mm-hmm. Here's the question. I think that if you follow the money, I think it's hard to beat Google at information. I do think that the message-based ad model at scale for scale's sake, can be challenged. You see what ad agencies are finally hitting some rocks.
That's why we do handmade advertising.
Exactly.
No, but
that's the name of our agency, by the way, is Artisanal, Joan. So thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Do you also make pickles?
No, we don't have pickles or beer. But
that'd be a better business, Joan.
All our ads are handmade by craftsmen in our little workshop here in Petaluma, California. Yeah. Actually, that's literally true. And that's kind of our way of trying to compete. That's fine. I'm not against Google because of scale. But they do have a lot of power. and Joan, you're an expert on how much power Facebook has in the political arena.
Yes. And this is one of the things that people have been trying to measure over the last, decade is how much political influence and opportunity does that present to political clients, right? And running social media through politics or running your politics through social media, rather. But also, I think that what's difficult about this case in particular with Foundum is that you have a part of the search engine that is devoted to making money, right? About, sharing shopping links, which often has some kind of advertising revenue attached to it. And so if people in their mind find Foundum on Google and then know to go to Foundum every time they want to search for a thing, then it presents a problem for Google because there's no longer that starting point. And that's an incentive to move people or to move other search engines off the platform. For instance, if you're searching for a flight, right, you might have
Google now owns travel, right?
They're trying to. But I'll tell you, if you search for flights, depending on the machine that you're using and the platform that you start at, you will get the same flight offered to you at different prices.
I know.
And location, I think data is implicated in this. And
you know what I'm finding, Joan, is that I'm a big United flyer. I fly everything United because that's where my miles are. And I have one trip that I was going to do coming up, and I couldn't find the right flight fares. And somebody used Google search and found far better fares on United than I was finding.
Mm. Wow.
Yes. Really interesting.
So here's what Google says. When you come to Google, when you search for what's the weather on Google, you don't want a link to weather.com. You want the weather. So we're going to show you the weather. Now, if I'm weather.com and they've scraped my weather and put it there so the searcher no longer comes to weather.com, I think both sides, there's merit in both arguments. It's true. Google is serving the user's interests. They're giving you the temperature and forecast. But boy, weather.com has a very good reason to be pissed off.
Well, yeah, and this happened. This used to happen as an interesting story in Phil Lapsley's Exploding the Phone about this, where people were calling operators for information. And this small town, there were two mortuaries. And so when someone died, they'd call the operator, and the operator happened to be married to someone who owned a mortuary, so she would automatically give her husband's business name.
Oh!
And in that, the other mortician wasn't getting any business, and he couldn't understand why, and then he figured out...
Well, his customers had died. Sorry.
Well, that's one. That would be good for business, right? In that case, but what was interesting is because we didn't have a telephone switch system, but we had humans networking the calls. Is that this business got a lot more attention, and so in some ways we have someone networking the information in a way that advantages them and advantages in-house products.
Google's basically the mortician's wife in this.
Okay, but let's look where Google gets it from all sides. So we talked about this before we were on the air. Edible Arrangements is suing Google because 1-800-Flowers is buying a search to give people an alternative to Edible Arrangements if you search for Edible Arrangements. And Edible Arrangements is trying to say, no, if people search for us, that's all you should show them.
And yeah, that's going to be a hard case to win.
Shouldn't get any alternatives there.
That's going to be a very hard case to win. And that's that would be like me saying, oh, Google, you're too good at advertising. I'm going to sue you. That's a company just, you got to compete. You got to be better than, Sherry's Cherries. Well, or
if the information were arranged in such a way that even if you Googled Edible Arrangements or 1-800-Flowers, what you'd come up with would be a sort of telephone book style information where, you know, it's all slotted under GIFs, right? Or
well, here,
like
I think their position
is a way of serving the information differently in terms of the way that you organize the content related to the category itself.
Right. So here's the, I did an incognito page because as you point out, it won't look the same if I do it with my own search. But here's, I think Edible Arrangements point is, well, look, somebody searched for Edible Arrangements. Clearly all they're interested in is us. Why do you allow our competitors to buy ads on the right hand side? But that's the ad unit right there, right?
And yeah, and I may not. I'm now used to saying that if I search for Nike, maybe I want to see what.
Now, if Edible Arrangements didn't buy this ad at the top of the page, they would not be at the top of the column in search results. You see what happens here. And I think this is defensive. So that the these are all ad units. This block and this block ad units. This is the first organic search. It's Edible Arrangements, but it's almost off the page. If Edible Arrangements hadn't purchased this ad, the number one result from the point of view of a consumer, it doesn't matter that it says ad there, is shop fruit arrangements from a competitor. So I could see their point of view. Leo searched for Edible Arrangements. Instead, the first result kind of organic result.
Well, this is actually the prior law on this. This is a trademark case. So I forget who it was. It was some cosmetics manufacturer said that if you search for Chanel, you shouldn't get.
Right. That's a counterfeit result.
Interesting.
Well, not so much counterfeit. Is that I was using somebody else's trademark.
Oh. And what happened in that case?
I forget. Jesus.
Oh, the real problem here is that you can't trust jurists and juries in cases like this to come up with consistent answers. That's the real problem. And I point to this weird link embedding case. Do you mind if we move on to that one from Edible Arrangements?
That's fine. Sure. Tipsy Elves versus Ugly Christmas Sweater Ink. I'm serious.
What?
I just searched for this. I haven't read it yet, but how can we resist this? Hold on. Okay, here we go.
Is this in the Westlaw database?
Is trademark use in Google AdWords trademark infringement?
Wow.
On May...
Oh, yeah, Tipsy Elves is those ugly Christmas sweaters, yeah.
Filed a complaint against Ugly Christmas Sweater Inc. based on Ugly's Christmas Sweater advertised material that appeared as a result of Googling the term Tipsy Elves.
See, that's the same thing.
Same thing.
You're searching for Tipsy Elves, and instead you're getting Ugly Christmas Sweater. And did they win?
It's similar to a case of Rosetta Stone. I don't know. This is June 2017. They filed the complaint in 2017, so it's probably still litigation.
Probably still in, yeah.
Rosetta Stone, I don't know.
Well, I just hope Tipsy Elves wins.
So if you use Tipsy Elves as a show title, are you infringing on their...
Only if I tell people to buy Tipsy Elves ugly Christmas sweaters, not ugly Christmas sweaters, ugly Christmas sweaters.
You know, one aspect we haven't touched upon... What about when everybody's got a Google Home or a shouldn't have said her name. Cancel. She's talking to me now. an Echo, etc. Now you say, show me, a product or whatever it is. It's just going to come in. You're not going to get a list to choose from.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And that's an issue all around. Are they going to sell that position? Google's never sold search.
Amazon has implied that it will sell its Echo results in some way. They've already said we're going to do some sort of ad sales around Echo.
That doesn't mean they're going to sell the recommendation. So if you're Kevin and you ask for deodorant, I don't know why I came up with that.
Yeah. Amazon will do Jeff. Is to say. Now, what it does right now, if I say I have stinky pits, Amazon Echo, get me some deodorant, it will say in your prime search results, you know, what you've bought before is this. But what if it said, in the past you've bought this, but what about this? We've got a great deal. How about a coupon for this?
Well, in fact, if you say to Pepsi, somebody searches for Pepsi, then you can buy the opportunity to push Coke.
Yes.
Right? Which is a holy grail.
Amazon is currently, according to CNBC, in talks with Clorox, Procter & Gamble, and others to promote their products on Echo. They're testing various ad types, including videos and promoted paid search results. So this is exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah, it's also a huge issue for media.
How
hey,
so?
You know who? Give me the news.
Right.
Well, who do you want? And you can go on Google and you can choose places, but that's like doing my Yahoo. Nobody ever did that.
So for the new Apple HomePod, if you say that to Hey Shlomo, she will say, I'm playing NPR, but if you want me to play Fox News or CNN, let me know. That's right at the first time you'd play news, and from then on, you don't get a choice.
Okay, but I'm going to do it. I'll turn the mic.
Do you have a HomePod?
Give me the news. NPR News, yeah.
Is that HomePod or Amazon?
That's of course not.
I didn't think it was. I was kind of interested.
It's my Google Home.
Yeah.
Leo, so, how dare you?
How dare you? I have them all. In fact, I have a stack. I have a Google Home Max, and on top of that, I have an Echo Show, and on top of that, I have the HomePod.
And are they leaving rings on each other?
Yeah,
turtles all the way down?
That's my, by the way, that's my joke, is I don't have to worry because, like any sensible person, I put a HomePod on top of an Echo. Or actually, I put it on top of a Sonos. So
right, you were going to change subjects a while ago.
I was going to talk about link embedding, but I can't find the, here it is. This and the EFF's all in a tizzy. Federal judge says embedding a tweet can be a copyright infringement. Did you see this?
This is tizzy worthy. That's, you bet.
Tizzy worthy. So a photographer is upset. Justin Goldman, he put on Snapchat a picture that he took of Tom Brady. Somebody tweeted his Snapchat picture, at which point Breitbart, Time, Yahoo, Vox Media, and Boston Globe, among others, retweeted the tweet with his picture in it without giving him credit. Goldman is sued saying those stories infringe my copyright. Now, this is not settled yet because this is he asked for a I guess the newspapers asked for a summary judgment, and the judge said, no, I don't think so. We're going to trial on this one. I think there's some merit in this. Judge Catherine Forrest of which circuit? I can't remember. The New York circuit said you can infringe copyright by embedding a tweet in a web page, contrary to the longstanding Perfect 10 versus Amazon test. She said this test, which is whose server does the infringing material lie on, is based in part on Catherine Forrest rejected the Ninth Circuit server test based in part on a surprising approach, I'm quoting the EFF, to the process of embedding. The opinion describes the simple process of embedding a tweet or image, something done every day by millions of ordinary internet users, as if it were a highly technical process done by coders. She says that process puts publishers, not servers, in the driver's seat. When defendants cause the embedded tweets to appear on their websites, their actions violated the photographer's exclusive display right. The fact that the image was hosted on Twitter's server does not shield them from this result.
Watch out, internet.
So, call me crazy, but if you are going to share, if I'm going to share a photo on a social sharing service.
Well, he shared it on Snapchat. I don't know if he shared it publicly. I'm not sure. That's unclear.
Then don't share it at all.
Right. Right.
Right. You know, sell it to Getty.
But sharing it on Snapchat, I don't think abrogates his copyright.
No. I'm from a legal standpoint, I understand and agree with you. I'm just thinking, you know, just common sense. We're setting ourselves up to fail when we forget how easy these tools are to use, how much they're used.
Absolutely.
And what they're used for.
So, absolutely.
So, yeah, I'm in a tizzy, too.
You're in a tizzy, too. I think there's still going to be a trial on this, but I might be mistaken. I think this was
a lot of places to file friends of the court applications in an appeal.
Yeah.
What it's like, I don't know. This is spinning my brain because isn't a retweet posting an embedded tweet? Like, isn't it like, wouldn't this trouble the entire platform?
Yes.
Itself?
Oh, it'd you be know, a like, huge problem.
Doesn't make any sense for copyright to intervene in this way. Because that is the fundamental technology and sharing and amplification are part and parcel of that. So I'm just like, I'm like looking into a mirror of a mirror of a mirror, trying to understand like, where would it even end? When it comes to sharing other people's thoughts and commenting on them and the conversant nature of social media. But yeah, if you do want copyright protections, then you're best to watermark your photos and crop them in such a way that if someone wants to use the whole thing, they have to contact you directly. You know, there are lots of ways in which people get paid for their content and those avenues are very clear. And so what is not clear is the avenues that are, you know, places where we know content production is intended to be shared for free.
She, the judge at the end said, we don't view this as being a decision that will have global consequences. She says there are a number of strong defenses to liability that separate this issue. In particular, genuine questions about whether the plaintiff effectively released his image into the public domain. We posted it to Snapchat. So she says there's also a very serious and strong fair use defense, a defense under the DMCA, and limitations on damages from innocent infringement. So she's merely throwing out the summary judgment without she's saying, I think she doesn't want to set a precedent. It's an interesting decision though, and interesting to read. not the least of which because her first sentence says, when the Copyright Act was amended in 1976, the words tweet, viral, and embed invoked thoughts of a bird, a disease, and a reporter.
This is a tech-savvy judge.
Decades later, they've taken on new meanings. Yeah, there is. The EFF was upset about the way she understood embedding, but I don't know if she's... I don't know. That's interesting. Anyway, not over yet.
Embedding is different than taking a screenshot, right?
Right.
And it gives proper attribution then.
Well, to the tweeter, not to the photographer.
Tweeter, but not to the,
then the first violation is really from the person who took it from Snapchat and posted on Twitter.
And it's a Section 230 question of the safe harbor.
Right. Twitter's not a defendant in this.
Right.
The publishers who retweeted the tweet are the defenders. Defendants.
Oh, because they purposely did.
Took that picture and retweeted. Let's say Time Magazine is one of the defendants. Retweeted that tweet. So I don't. It's an interesting case. I'm sure we'll be talking about it on Friday in This Week in Law. Uh-huh. Now here's the good stuff Google does. Google AI can predict heart attacks just by looking at your eyes. Now, I know all the privacy advocates are going to say, oh, that's terrifying.
Exactly.
this comes from Verily, Google's life extension moonshot. They can use photographs of the retina to predict factors for cardiovascular disease. It works about as well as currently used predictive methods and is far less invasive.
Mm-hmm. Right. We actually talk about this on tomorrow's IoT podcast just because of the machine learning aspect of it, because that's what they've done here. They have gone back and scanned the retinal images of prior patients from years back, and then knowing 5 years later that those same patients did have heart disease, they looked for the signs in the retina, and then now applied that through machine learning to current retinal scans, and they come up, I think it was 70% accuracy in the current.
71%, yeah.
Right, and it's 72% if they take blood, which is how today's typical process works.
Based on the eye scan, the algorithm was able to predict a person's age to within 3.25 years, smoking status with 71% accuracy, and blood pressure within 11 units of the upper number reported in the measurement. And using that data, they could then predict major cardiovascular events.
Huh.
with as you say, 70% accuracy. That's very interesting.
It is. See, technology's not so bad.
Yeah. until your insurance company starts taking pictures of you on the street looking to see if you're going to have a heart attack and denies you, sends you a picture with their red light camera saying, sorry, Jeff, you can't get a insurance because we could see from your eyes you're going to get sick.
That is very panoptic, Leo.
Hey, I'm like all about the panopticon, man.
A bad path on this show. One of the things that is intriguing to me about networked medicine and medicine derived from AI at this stage is, you know, a lot of people gave those samples and never really were informed of the uses and the possibilities for what, you know, so I'm wondering, you know, did at any time the people who's had their retina scanned and their medical records released, you know, what is the process by which Google created and contained that data set? Because there's a lot of questions in medicine particularly that raise those very concerns, which is that we have the Health Insurance Privacy and Portability Act for a reason, which is that we are somewhat suspect of corporations finding out our health information and using it against us. And so to me, you know, this leads to a different, you know, this is a similarly bad path. But I do wonder, you know, how that data set was generated.
You know, Joan, there was a case in the UK not that long ago where there was data that would have enabled the prediction of kidney disease. That was disallowed because that was not a use that was anticipated when the data was gathered, which sends me into a tizzy because you can't anticipate. In a world of AI, you by definition are not anticipating all future uses of data because you don't know what you're going to see.
Yeah. And, you know, there are ways when you go to the hospital, you sign, you know, that research is, you know, part of, you know, if you get a biopsy, often your blood that's collected is, they only need a tiny, tiny bit of it to run those tests. And then the bio waste, as it's called, circulates in a tissue economy. And there's a heavy price on that bio waste in order to make those scientific findings. And so I'm interested to think about, you know, what is the waste of our x-rays and of our scans and of our MRIs, and how is that comprising a market at this point?
So here's an interesting story from The Information. What if you were a little startup, maybe you have a smart lock and you took money from Amazon's fund, investment money, to help you work better with Amazon's Echo? Then what if Amazon came along and made it $100 million offer to buy you, an offer you considered too low, so you turned it down? Then what if Amazon came along and said, well, we're just going to build our own, and announced Amazon Key? That's what happened to August. And I know, Kevin, you know all about these. In fact, I think Stacy loves the August locks, right? I can't remember.
She does. And it's a great lock. It's interesting that this is coming up with August. Only it's a timing thing because they were just purchased by
Asa Abloy bought them.
Asa Abloy, the people who make Yale locks.
Yeah.
Right, $150 million. But one of the less recent instances of this was a company called Nucleus, and they made with the fund backing,
I'm sorry too, but we can't call it the Echo Fund because that's not its name.
Right. They made a touchscreen device, probably about 8 inches square. It would hang on your wall. You could do video chats with it. It would integrate with the Echo voice services to provide data and so on and so forth. And you could play music from it and whatnot. Well, doesn't that sound a lot like the Echo Show?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that came out after Nucleus got their funding from Amazon and tried to put the product out. And then the show came and basically the Nucleus people were like, what just happened?
Amazon said, of course, told The Information, the company doesn't use information gained through investments to help it develop a competing product. But if we should happen to learn a thing or two, what would it hurt? The information also tells the story, of course, of Imagination Technologies, which is a GPU company that made graphics processors for Apple. Apple hired a few of their employees, considered buying the firm, and then just said, nah, we're going to make our own. Bye. And Imagination's pretty much gone. Interesting. You know, these companies are so big and so powerful. At the same time, you want to reward them for the reason they're big and powerful is they're changing the world. They're making great products.
Yeah.
They didn't get big and powerful by screwing people. Or did they?
Well, in that case, does prove that point. I mean, what's interesting to me as sort of a scholar of technology is to think about, you know, when you talk about a smart home. So if you're making a product for a smart home, you start to think about, okay, so what are the things in the home people are going to want to control? Temperature, definitely, the locks, you know, ventilation. If they have a swimming pool, if the filter's on and off, right? So they're, you know, the electricity, do you want to be able to shut the lights on and off? And so it's not outside the bounds to reason that if you are someone that's building a smart home technology, that locks would be, on your list of things to do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, if you make a play and you get caught, you do have to own up to that and say, well, we knew this technology was already built and we didn't want to have to build it from the ground up. Or they wanted to, you know, to me, this is anti-competitive in the sense that they know that this is a rising star on this market, right, and they want to acquire and then probably kill, right?
But at the same time, I mean, I think about what Facebook did with Snapchat. They you know, Facebook's pattern is to buy competitors like Instagram, like WhatsApp, and fold them into the Facebook family. That way, if you're going to leave Facebook to use WhatsApp, well, at least you'll be using a Facebook product. When they couldn't buy Snapchat, they just they enhanced Instagram to beat Snapchat, and it worked. By the way, it seems to be working. But that doesn't feel like that's illegal. That's competitive. So this is the problem. It's hard. And boy, Microsoft's famous for, you know, engulf and devour. I can't remember what the term was we used to use about Microsoft, but that was the idea. They would do exactly the same thing. They'd pretend to want to buy a company. They'd find out all about it. Then they'd not buy them and do something competitive. But Microsoft was famous for being a hard charging competitor. Bill Gates always wanted to win. He played really hard. And you want companies to play really hard. But so it's tricky.
Yeah, there's that. And then, you know, ultimately they can't be everything to everyone. Right. And so part of it is understanding as they expand the possibilities of these technologies and get into different markets and aggregate, you know, all of these users into a very large platform, that also makes it really difficult for anyone new to step into the market in small sections or subsections of those technology spaces, because starting up a technology company is extremely expensive. Yeah. And so one of the things that not only do you shift the kinds of innovation that are possible, but you also really limit the product space in a way that, you know, it'd be nice if we had, you know, many different phone cameras to pick from. And that we, you know, instead of having just a few that work well.
Here's a New York supermarket. Tops files bankruptcy, cites debt and Amazon. That might just be a convenient fall guy. Yeah, it's debt. We had a lot of debt. Oh, and Amazon. It's got to be. I mean, if you're a brick and mortar store, if you're selling anything on the internet, if you're doing any commerce of any kind, even if you're just doing health insurance, you got to be worried about Amazon in every respect. But that's ultimately good for consumers as long as they play fair, I guess. Is that it? Play fair?
We just don't know if they are. That's, I think, the
tricky
part.
It's hard to know. Yeah. That's why we have courts. Let's see. Samsung S9, we're going to have live coverage on Sunday. Father Robert Ballasaire and Ron Richards begins 9 a.m. Pacific noon Eastern time of the Samsung event in Barcelona from Mobile World Congress. They are expected to announce a new S9 for a lot more money with dual lenses. The FCC is inspecting Ajit Pai. Oh, we already talked about that. I just can't resist bringing it up again. let me say that again. The FCC is investigating its own chairman because, well, it's a little suspicious that the FCC, at his behest, dropped their media ownership rules right before Sinclair announced its intention to buy Tribune Media for $3.9 billion. What do they know and when do they know it, right? That's always the question.
Yeah.
All right, I could tell you're losing energy. So we're going to take a break, and we will wrap this up with your any picks or plugs or tips or tricks. Anything?
Did we just mention that Dave Moore lost his case against Google for the record?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
For the record,
Just let the record show that.
The National Labor Relations Board says, no, you can't create a hostile environment. Sorry. That's a good reason for getting fired.
Uh-huh.
Jimmy?
Yeah, and there was a very interesting Q&A that happened with him. He was on a panel at Portland State University either late last week or over the weekend. And I watched the Q&A on YouTube, and students had some pretty strong criticisms of the biological theories that he was using to support his position that women aren't excellent coders and engineers.
No, can't do it.
And so I was really proud of the students that stood up to him, as well as stood up to the moderator and his co-panelist, and said that, you know, we have a history of scientific racism, and we thought that was good data at the time, and now we have you picking and choosing certain biological data to support your case, and how should we know that this is verified and trusted data? And so I think the students are taking a really critical approach to thinking about what DeMoore was trying to push in terms of a public conversation, and I don't think they're taking the bait.
Okay. Anything else? Any last?
No, I just want to get that one.
I agree. Jeff, prepare your number. Kevin, if you've got a IoT device we should all be buying, I've got my checkbook on the ready.
Joan, if you got a new troll.
And Joan, if you have any fake news you want to spread.
I'm getting back channeled by a reporter at Politico who's chasing down a troll right now, and I'm trying to help him in the midst of all this.
I love this. Joan Donovan, troll hunter.
That's a YouTube Red Series waiting to happen.
Once you know where they hang out, they're creatures of habit, as we all are.
I need to talk to you.
Yeah, you come hang out in the office. I'd love to have you.
I need some help. This is good. I like this. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you are buying a new home, you probably are not bringing out the checkbook to pay for it in cash. You got to get a loan, right? A mortgage. Did you know the word mortgage comes from the French word for death? I think the intention was more like this is something you owe until you die, but really, if anybody's ever gone to a bank to apply for a loan, you understand where that derivation comes from. It's not fun. That's why Rocket Mortgage came along. From Quicken Loans, the best lender in the country. Number one in customer satisfaction year after year. And I tell you, they're guaranteed to win that award again this year because of Rocket Mortgage. They put the entire mortgage process in your hands, in your phone, literally in your hands. You don't need to go to a bank. You don't need to go to the attic to find paperwork. All you need is to go to rocketmortgage.com/twig. Answer a few simple questions. Allow them to contact your financial institutions. They're all trusted partners. And boom, based on your income, assets, and credit, they crunch the numbers and in minutes make you an offer. You can choose the rate, the term, the down payment. It's all up to you. It's completely transparent. Once you find a loan option you like, they say, good, you're approved. It's fast enough you could do it at an open house. You literally get approved in minutes. This is such a revolution compared to the old way of doing it. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, and mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twig. rocketmortgage.com/twig. They're an equal housing lender, of course. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. rocketmortgage.com/twig. And by the way, interest rates are, we know, going to be going up. You would be behoove you to lock in a low interest rate with a refi. So they do that too. rocketmortgage.com/twig. Kevin, let's get a tip from Mr. IoT Podcast at iotpodcast.com.
Oh, can it be more Chromebooky?
Yeah. Heck yeah.
A Google show? That's
heck yeah. Jeff lives on his Chromebook. Yeah. He loves his Chromebook. Are you, Kevin, let me ask you, do you use a Chromebook like Jeff does exclusively? Is that like your go-to?
Well, it wasn't up until about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
When I was working at Google, I was using a Chromebook. I either my own Chromebook Pixel or a work-issued Chromebook. And then I got away from it for a while. But with my free time lately, I've been doing online coding, and I'm like, oh, how am I gonna learn my programming classes and such with the Chromebook, right? There's tons of cloud-based programming things out there, but they still just weren't doing it for me. So Jeff, I don't know if you're like learning how to code or want to. It's really cool, I think, but that's neither here nor there. You can do it on a Chromebook pretty easily if you use the Secure Shell web app, which find it right in the Chrome Web Store. And what you do is, or one of the things you can do, just buy a cheap Raspberry Pi for $30-$40.
Brilliant.
So what I did was I put a Raspberry Pi. Actually, we're running our IoT voicemail that I built in Python on that. And it's got Python installed. And I just use SSH, the Secure Shell, to log in. And it's a very native experience in the Chromebook. But here's the best part. So I actually write my code using a text editor on the Chromebook. There are native Chrome apps for that, Text or Carrot or two are the decent ones. I just save the files over to the Pi on my network. And the funny thing is the Secure Shell client allows for SFTP. So I can mount the Pi in the Files app of the Chromebook. So it's just right there. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Well, so I'm going to top you. I'm gonna give you one that I used this SFTP for a long time, but if you can, and since you do control your Raspberry Pi, if you can control the server that you're logging into, put Mosh, M-O-S-H on it, and then get the Mosh Chrome extension. It will look exactly the same to you. It's still SSH. It's secure. They have SFTP as well. But what Mosh does is it preserves the connection. So the one problem is sometimes the connection drops or whatever. So your session is preserved across disconnections, across disruptions, and it's
that's handy.
Yeah, I really like Mosh. It's an open source project, and actually now I'm looking. I know there's a Mosh extension because I use it on my Chromebook, but I don't see it here. But you have to put Mosh on the Raspberry Pi. Because basically you're connecting with a Mosh server. It's easy to do. It's you can do an apt-get and get it. But take a look at that as another option for a mobile shell because it really helps. It's a little faster. It just helps with the trickiness of doing what you're doing, which is pretending that you're on the Raspberry Pi in effect.
Right. Yeah. I'm actually blown away by how much the Android apps and the Chrome OS experience has improved in the past year or so. It's been
still has a little ways to go.
Just a little. Yep.
We all love our Pixelbooks though. I think.
Yeah, I do.
Right? It's fair to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, when you spend that much money on a Chromebook, you better darn well.
You
love
better.
It. Yeah. And you're doing? Are you learning Python? What are you playing with?
Some Java, some Python. Python just seems to be easiest for me to pick up these days.
It's a great language to start with. Yeah. Very nice. Mr. Jeff Jarvis, your pick of the week.
This one should amuse me a little bit. Yes. So analyst says on CNBC that Twitter and Snap will grow at the expense of Facebook. What just amuses me about that is that how long ago was it? About 3 weeks ago when, Snap, Twitter, they're nearly
dead. It's over.
And now suddenly the fortunes change.
Listen to analysts, I think,
all
is the rule.
BS. Yeah.
Actually, Snap is not giving up.
No, I do too. Gumption would be the word for them. Yeah.
They're getting a lot of heat from more than a million users who say, I hate the new interface. But, you know, I think I should check the change.org petition. But the last time I checked, it was.
I think we had something in the rundown where you can revert or something.
Yeah, I don't know how well that works.
Here's how to reverse the update on Android.
In theory.
That's not going to, no.
Oh, here's Snap's response. 1.2 million signatures to Nick and all of the Snapchatters who signed the petition. We hear you. We appreciate you took the time to let us know how you feel. This is how a company should respond to these petitions. They're explaining why they're doing it. We are going to do some more changes. The new foundation is just the beginning. In other words, we're not going to do what you want us to do, which is revert.
Right. But which is very Facebook. You know,
but
very
at least they're responding.
Newsfeed. Everybody hated the news feed. And Zuckerberg said, nope.
Yeah. I think companies have to have a strong vision and follow it. So that's I'm going to make your number 1.226252 million. That's how many people
signed
the petition. Joan, is there anything you'd like to plug or pick?
So there was a book that came out today that is really interesting for people who are interested in technology. It's called Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism by Cynthia Noble. And so she's a information studies scholar at UCLA, has been working on this book for several years. And what's interesting is the way that she challenges the notion of the algorithm here and then looks at what are the inputs and outputs and how do search engines discover and create and reinforce the biases that we are all very familiar with related to racism and sexism and homophobia. And she's got some really interesting ways of doing search as well as of cataloging these instances and case studies. And I should say that the kind of research that she does is impactful in the sense that these Google and corporations, they don't, have teams devoted internally that are doing this kind of work in the way that she does. And so her research to me is really provocative in the sense that it gets us an outsider's perspective on how to reimagine what it means to serve, curate, and distribute information. And so, I'm really, really happy that the book is out and available through Amazon. And last I heard this morning, it was actually sold out right now. And so I don't know if it's still true, but it's ranking, I think, number one, according to your screenshot there. So.
Yeah.
And so it's a very popular book, and there's already a lot of conversation on social media about it and about what it would take to think about an information first perspective and also to think about search engines as having dimensions where people are affected or where groups are affected and where in a lot of ways our most harmful prejudices are amplified.
Yeah. This is another approach to the same thing we've been talking about the whole show, which is how these companies affect us and sometimes unconsciously affect us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that people are doing the studies and looking and bringing it to the surface because it's so easy to have unconscious inputs and affect you and change your point of view in a way that's not right. So I think this is really good.
It's true. Yeah. And there are a series of questions in the book, even on the cover, that if you were to search in autocomplete to this day certain keywords and questions, I know that Google is working on the problem, but definitely hasn't solved for it. And so what's dangerous about the autocomplete in that sense is it is bringing you directly to biased information by suggesting it. And I think that part of that has to do with the way people are asking questions of the platform itself when they are searching. And so it's a really interesting way of understanding how society gets encoded into the algorithms.
Sigh.
Oh, come on, Leo. I have fun.
Are you an optimist? I hope you are.
I am. And I also picked out this book, which I should say is a very good read. It's called The Witches.
Are we just talking about burning people at the stake?
Well, this book has made me think a lot about what it means to do fake news, because it's a really neat historical take on the Salem witch trial. And, you know, I grew up near Boston and had many, many experiences in Salem. And so it was an excellent read from a historian, which is called The Witches, Salem, 1692, A History.
I want to read that. That sounds great.
It's really dense and goofy and everything I love about a good history book.
I was just reading somewhere that it's kind of that we kind of misunderstood what happened in Salem, that we have a lot of urban myths or legends about it that aren't accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I will read it. Thank you for being here. Joan Donovan works at Data and Society. You can find her at datasociety.net, on the Twitter at Boston Joan. She's Boston strong. And I hope you got to talk with your aunt a little bit, because we thank you.
I did. Thank you.
Spending a little time with us instead of your family.
Joan, we appreciate you dumping your aunt for us.
Okay, that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, you know, right place, right time. And so I appreciate y'all having me on. It's it's truly like...
Always a pleasure. You're a hit.
To be able to hang out and talk.
We love your brains. It's nice to get your brains. And boy, there's no... Your beat is the most timely beat there can be right now.
I know. The work doesn't stop. But, you know, I feel like a normal job that, you know, when I'm ready for retirement, I can start, you know, I can go back to the university and teach my classes and, you know.
We need you on the front lines.
I know. It's a strange job.
All we have is stands between us and Putin.
No pressure, though.
I haven't evaluated that claim.
Well, do some research, okay, and get back to us.
I will.
You are a nuclear arsenal.
That's Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism, City University of New York. He's all that stands between us and the Harvard comma. We are
Buzz Oxford.
Oxford comma. Actually, I'm sure you're a fan of the Oxford comma.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so it's the other way around.
I'm not just a fan, it's a moral responsibility.
Yes, he's all that stands between us and hanging participles. How about that?
Yeah, that's better.
Busmachine.com. Whatever happened to copy editors? That's what I want to know. Dang it. At gone. Jeff Jarvis on the Twitter. Gone. And he joins us every week. You'll be back next week, I hope.
I plan to be. If you'll have me.
I plan on it. Maybe we get Stacy back, too. She's in Berlin right now with Bosch. But she sent an able replacement in Kevin Toefler, co-host on IoT Podcast, iotpodcast.com, at Kevin C. Toefler on the Twitter. Great to see you, Kevin.
Happy to be here. Thanks again.
Any new Beatles in news? Anything worth, like all those Beatles documentaries on Netflix? Anything good I should look for?
Nothing recent. Yeah. Nothing recent. I know Ringo had some reissues of his first albums and whatnot, but
I can live without those, I think.
Yeah.
I'll be okay without those.
I'll let him know.
I almost bought a turntable the other day. I came this close. Then I thought, well, then I have to buy records.
They make it easy. Come out one whole set on Amazon, of course.
Yeah. How many times have I bought the Beatles, actually? If I counted, it would be depressing. Many, many, many.
That was a business model, yeah.
Yeah. Just keep buying it. We don't have to make new music. Just keep buying remixes. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We do This Week in Google. It's my last show of my week because now I take Thursday and Friday off, and I'll be back on Saturday. But I do it about 1:30 Wednesday afternoon. That's Pacific time, 4:30 Eastern time, 21:30 UTC. You do the math. You can watch live at twit.tv/live. You can, if you're live, you should by all means go in the chat room. And boy, the chat room's been great today.
As ever.
irc.twit.tv. If you have an IRC client, you can use that. But if you don't, there's a website and a web client. But we do love having you in chat. Thank you for being here. You can also visit us in studio. We had a nice studio visitor today who ran out of the room. No, he actually, it's interesting. He plays the contrabass clarinet for the United States Navy Band. And he's performing at Sonoma State tonight. And he just thought he had a little time. He'd come and watch the show. But
I was afraid it was something I said.
He had to leave. No, he has to go tune up his clarinet. You know, the reeds on those contrabasses take a long time to moisten. I don't know if that's true or not. If you want to be in studio, please don't surprise us. Please just email tickets at twit.tv so we can have a nice comfy chair set out for you, give you the roll out the welcome mat and all of that. Tickets at twit.tv. While you're at the website, twit.tv, don't forget our podcast, twit.tv/twig. On-demand versions of the show available there, audio and video. Of course, you can always subscribe either there or on any podcast client of your choice and get it every single week automatically delivered to your phone or your tablet or your computer. And man, I love these new voice assistants because you can listen to the show on every single one of them, whether it's the Apple HomePod or the Amazon Echo or even like the Cortana device from Harman Kardon, the Google Home device. All you have to do is basically, in almost every case, is say, I want to listen to This Week in Google or listen to Twig, and you should be able to get the most recent
episode. Okay, Google, play This Week in Google.
This is going to be a very Inception moment.
Yay.
Is it playing? You didn't know it could do that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah. You can also...
Sorry.
You can also listen to Twit Live in many cases. Just say listen to Twit Live. Yeah, you can hear the live stream. Yeah, wow. I think this is the biggest thing that's ever happened to podcasts, frankly, is these voice assistants.
Yeah. Jeff, you could just hold that up to the microphone and take the week off, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It'll just play last week's show.
And go. Jeff always says the same things anyway.
No, you don't, Jeffrey. You do not. We are doing, I think, a few more weeks of the survey. If you haven't done it yet, twit.tv/survey. Because we don't collect information about you like Google and Facebook, we don't know anything about you. And sometimes it's nice when an advertiser says, well, do any women listen, to be able to say, yes, there are a couple. So go to twit.tv/survey and fill that out. Represent. Let us know. I filled it out. Yes, thank you.
It's probably wrong, but I did it.
Yeah, you know what? We do it in aggregate. We usually get more than 20,000 responses, so it'll dilute you. Anyway, we don't save any information about you personally. We don't share any information about you personally. Don't worry. Your information's safe. But it does help us a lot. twit.tv/survey. Thanks for joining us. I'll see you next week. This Week in Google. Bye-bye.